be seated. Audio tech may want to crank me up a little bit. I'm still nursing a frog. I don't know how you nurse a frog, but I'm doing it. By the end of the message, I may be squeaking or chirping. Did you hear the Walmart shopper who pepper sprayed 20 fellow shoppers last Black Friday? They were fighting over some electronic device. In New York that day, crowds looted a clothing store. At a Walmart near Phoenix, a man was bloodied while being subdued by police officers for his own misbehavior. I guess he was trying to shoplift a video game or something. There was a shooting outside a store in San Leandro, California. Shots were fired at a mall in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and a stabbing outside a store in Sacramento, New York. Black Friday is certainly living up to its name. Maybe we should call it Black Eye Friday or something. So much for peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Where's the milk of human kindness when these things happen? What happened to our society? When some literally will step all over you to get whatever they want, or think they want, or think they need. What happened to civility and love of your neighbor? Here's a quiz. Won't take long, you'll have to answer out loud, but take the quiz. Name the 5 wealthiest people in the world. Name the last 5 Heisman Trophy winners. Name 10 people who have won the Nobel or Pulitzer Prize. Name the World Series winners of the last 10 years. So how'd you do? The point is, none of us remembers the headliners of yesterday. These people are not second-rate achievers. They're the best in their field. But the applause dies. The awards tarnish. The achievements are forgotten, the accolades and the certificates are buried with their owners. Try another quiz. Name 3 friends who have helped you through a difficult time. Name 5 people who have taught you something worthwhile. Think of a few people who have made you feel appreciated. Think of 5 people with whom you enjoy spending time. You probably did much better on the second quiz. Much better. People who make a real impact in our life are not the ones with the most credentials, the most money, the most honor, the most rewards. They are those who care the most. Today we'll look at the New Testament account of an evangelist who really cared about a man, a friend and his slave, who were also brothers in the faith. He cared not just for their friendship, but for their salvation. They might be found acceptable in Yahweh's eyes in light of a certain crisis that was going on. The lesson is found in a short book, only 25 verses. It's called the Book of Philemon. It's one we don't usually refer to, but I'd like to look at it today. Sometimes the lesser is more. We get more out of the small things sometimes than, you know, the big blast, the ones that everybody talks about. Applying the lessons of this book is even more critical now today, I think, than any other time in history. Because we live in a world that increasingly cares less about others. We actually see it in the aggression of drivers. We all see it every day, which is getting worse. In the shortness of tempers, in the rudeness of the emailer or the texter, the general disrespect for the elderly and those in authority. We see it in the actions of the Wall Street occupiers and in the disrespect presidential candidates receive. You wouldn't see a lot of this stuff 30, 40, 50 years ago. You would just shake your head if you saw it back then. This world is being ripped apart, ripped to shreds everywhere, from marriages to nations, because people harbor animosity and they cannot forgive. They can't bring themselves to overlook wrongs. Maybe to say, maybe I was wrong. Or maybe just say, I forgive. This shouldn't come as any surprise. Yahshua said it would be so. He said in Matthew 24:12, and because iniquity shall abound, that means lawlessness, that means sin, says the love of many is going to wax cold. Who is he talking about? The year 20? How about the year 2011? I think that's what he's talking about. In other words, people's benevolence toward each other, the milk of human kindness, would wane because of escalating evil in the culture. I mean, let's face it. I see people walking along the road, and one of my impulses is to stop and help the hitchhiker. But at the same time, I'm thinking, the guy could have a gun. And how often do we read about that? Commandeer my car, push me out. So you just keep on going because the iniquity abounds in our culture. Bad attitudes incite more bad attitudes. Add the stress of a bad economy and the worries surrounding our unsafe world, and everything just exacerbates. Callous behavior increases exponentially. We live in a society that knows less and less about forgiveness. I mean, think about it. Hollywood makes heroes out of the Dirty Harrys and the Rambos. Getting even is priority number one today. It's one reason we have so many broken homes. Road rage, which would be inconceivable, but even more inconceivable are these mass shootings. You know, we used to call it going postal. Going into a workplace and just start shooting your fellow workers. Unbelievable. Or go into a restaurant and do the same thing. People don't even know. People who can't forgive are carrying around a boatload of self-destructive behavior, anger, acting in ways they probably later on wish they hadn't. It's been said, speak when you're angry, and you'll make the best speech you will ever regret. For the believer, failing to forgive is unacceptable. When the people of Samaria did not welcome Yahshua and his disciples, two of his disciples just wanted to flame him. Go to Luke chapter 9, verse 54. And when the disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Master, will you that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? How about that? They treated them badly, so he said, let's just incinerate these people. Just as Elijah did, you know, the prophets of Baal. But he turned and rebuked them and saying, you don't know what manner of spirit you are of. If the disciples, brethren, if the disciples had that issue, what about us? Do we have that same kind of spirit? They had a lot to learn about forgiveness. Yahshua commands us in Matthew 18 to forgive. Over and over in that chapter, forgive. 18 verse 21, then Peter came to him and said, Master, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? I get a kick out of Peter. He gives him a number. Okay, I fulfilled my seven. Now I don't have to forgive anymore. Yahshua said unto him, I say not unto you until seven times, but unto 70 times seven. In other words, an infinite number. Peter was looking for a specific limit on how many times he's got to forgive his brother who sins against him. And I analyzed Peter's question. Master, how often shall my brother trespass against me and I forgive him? We learn from his question, number one, that he knew he had to forgive, because Yahshua had spoken about this over and over. He doesn't question the need. He didn't say, Yahshua, do I have to forgive these people? I mean, look what they did to me. Do I really have to forgive them? He knew he had to. Clearly, Yahshua taught his disciples that lesson in Matthew 6:14. For if you forgive men when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. And the reverse, of course, is understood. If you don't, Yahshua won't forgive you either. And that's also found in other places in Yahshua's teachings. Peter has not forgotten what Yahshua said. He knows that he must not bear a grudge against his brother or meditate about revenge, but forget the wrong done and get right with his brother again. Second, in his mind is a big deal for him to forgive up to seven times. He means not just seven times a day. Peter's talking about seven times in his life. Is that enough? Yahshua said to watch yourselves. If your brother sins, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you seven times in a day, and seven times comes back to you and says, I repent, forgive him. Just count the man as a little bit weak and he can't control himself, but just forgive him. So Peter wants to know, will seven times do the job? He could have asked the question without trying to influence the answer by giving him a number. In our humanness, there's a natural desire not to have to do something like this. It just comes naturally. Not to do too much good, or we might look weak, or forgiving too much, maybe too fast, maybe people work against us, though, you know, Yahweh has forgiven us very much. Think about Yahshua and what he did for us. Yahshua answered Peter's seven with an infinite number. Forgiving then means forgetting as well. And that's even harder to do. True forgiveness doesn't keep score. Yahweh is the scorekeeper. Let him worry about it. Yahweh is the one who keeps account because he is our judge and payback is his job, not ours. Deuteronomy 32:34, is not this laid up in store with me and sealed up among my treasures? To me belongs vengeance and recompense, Yahweh says. To me. It's not your job. Their foot shall slide in due time, for the day of their calamity is at hand, and the things that shall come upon them make a haste. He says, don't worry. If they don't repent, comeuppance will come in due time. Don't worry about it. Don't be so quick to want to take things into your own hands. Yahshua taught us to ask in his model prayer. He said, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass or sin or trespass or do something wrong and wrong us. It's a two-way street, as he says. Two-way street. Our culture, however, says otherwise. And our culture is a very powerful teacher. I mean, through the media, through the entertainment, through all the different ways. Our culture is a very powerful teacher, and it's doing a very good job. It says you don't need to forgive. In fact, you have a right to your pound of flesh. I remember an ambulance chasing lawyer advertised on TV one time with a famous actor. Maybe you saw it. He says, if you're injured in an accident, tell those responsible that you mean business, then call our law firm. We'll squash them. We'll make them pay. They're profiting from a purely human response. So whether they're justified in suing or not, what they're teaching is go after them. That's your first response. Go after them. Which may make a lawyer rich, but it does nothing but promote ill will. And it teaches. It teaches others how to do the same. In contrast, Yahshua teaches forgiveness and even the proper response to a lawsuit. He said, if someone sues you, give them your coat, and for good measure, give them your shirt too. If any man will sue you at law, take away your coat, let him have your cloak also, he said. Whether he won the case against you legitimately or just had a good lawyer. He says, your response of pain beyond the judgment is an act of humility and forgiveness. How is that guy going to feel when you go above and beyond what he sued you for? He's going to say, wait a minute, what kind of guy is this? I've never heard such a thing. And it would take some of the satisfaction maybe away from his win and perhaps make him rethink his own actions. There's a lot of teaching that could happen there. Matthew 5:38. Yahshua says, you have heard that has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, by saying to you that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite you on the right cheek, turn to him the other cheek also. I don't believe this is meant as a literal response so much as, you know, it just like plucking out your eye and throwing it away is not a literal response, but instructs us to repay only by the same measure as we are harmed and no more. You couldn't go beyond that, which would be not just avenging, but revenging or revenge. Whosoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him twain. If a soldier who has authority over you or some kind of a government official or something conscripts your services to carry something, he said, you have no choice but to do it. But after you reach the end of your task, then you're again a, quote, you know, free man. You can go about your business, so to speak. Then you can say, well, you want me to carry a little further? I'd be glad to do so. See, now the initiative is yours. And you choose to help out this person. You show that doing good is better than forced compliance and is the way of Yahshua. Today's philosophy is that it's okay to blame somebody for your actions. Forgiveness is anything but encouraged. Instead of giving the stamp of approval to what quarreling couples want to do anyway, that is an immediate divorce, the divorce people, the ones that they go to, the counselors and so forth, just say, yeah, go ahead. What are your terms and when do you want it? Now, why don't they say, hey, you know what? That's the last resort. How about trying to save the marriage? How about your situation is not impossible? You fell in love once. You can do it again. You can always work things out. Now go home and work it out. Imagine the hundreds of thousands of families that could be saved if someone just said no. Splitting up is not an option, let alone your first response. Imagine the untold pain and the psychological scars left in the children. Those who can't bring themselves to forgive others are traveling down a road of destruction. Not just in this life either, brethren. Yahshua said, if you forgive not men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive yours. If you can't forgive a wrong done, you're going to be imprisoned by your past. That's what he's teaching. It will always be there, haunting you through life and keeping this wound open and festering. And it's always there, and you live with it day in and day out. Feelings of anger and resentment are going to eat you up. Why do people, I've often wondered, you ever notice when people age, some get real mellow, others get real bitter. And the older they get, the more bitter they get. Perhaps because the bitter ones can't forgive past wrongs and it's built up within them over and over and multiplied over and over in their life. And they start looking at life very pessimistically and they see nothing but bad in life and bad in people. Bitterness calcified in their bones till it just eats them up. You know, even our physical bodies respond to this. If that isn't, you know, if Josh's words aren't enough, think about what it's doing to your health. As the saying goes, life is too short to hold a grudge, also too long. Anger and resentment can make you sick and shorten your life. Unforgiving people will get ill more often, they found. Researchers at Harvard found that nursing a grudge puts your body through the same strains as a major stressful event. Muscles tense, blood pressure rises, sweating increases. One study found a link between forgiving someone for a betrayal and their improvements in blood pressure and heart rate and a decreased workload for the heart. And I would add more, I would add even less illness. Less colds and less flu when there's less stress. Forgiveness opens the door and lets the prisoner out. Forgiveness sets you free from your past. You know, as soon as you forgive, the burden lifts. You ever, or you know, if you confess to somebody a wrong, the burden lifts. You don't have this weight on your back. Day in and day out, you feel free. The clouds part. Sunshine comes in. Solomon says it's to a man's glory to overlook a transgression. Proverbs 19:11. Also keep in mind that an unforgiving attitude opens the doors to the wiles of Satan. Ephesians 4:26 says, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold." Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. That doesn't mean stay awake and battle it out with your spouse or somebody else. It means just forgive. Just forgive. 2 Corinthians 2:10 reads, "If you forgive anyone, I'll forgive him. And what I have forgiven, if there is anything to forgive, I've forgiven in the sight of Messiah for your sake, in order that Satan might not outwit us." See, he's using everything he can. Anything he can grab hold of and twist us up into a pretzel, Satan will do that, Yahshua said. We're not unaware of his schemes. He's there. Don't give him any slack. Don't give him any room. Well, at this foundation, let's go back to what we talked about at the beginning. Let's take a look, a quick tour of the very short book of Philemon. There we learn the spiritual duty to forgive. It comes to us not in principle, not in parable, not in word pictures, but in a very personal account. A very friend of the Apostle Paul is involved here. It centers on a man named Philemon. He's married to Apphia, and they have a son, Archippus, who's in the ministry. They have a house where the assembly has met. There you see it. Not really. It's just a house. There's a house in the Middle East, kind of probably how it looked, as was common, and they have a slave named Onesimus. Now, in no place in Scripture is there any effort made to abolish slavery. I want to talk about that a bit. You know, the atheists will say, "Well, you know, that Bible isn't true. How can it be true if there's a loving father and he allows slavery?" You know, you hear that a lot. There's no effort made to abolish slavery, per se. I mean, widespread, all-encompassing. No man of Yahweh in the New Testament ever attacked slavery. And it may seem odd for us to own people. You know why? Because we don't understand the concept of slavery back then. It's totally different from what we think about, you know, when this country had slaves. It's really, when you think about it, not much different between you and your employer. That's the kind of slavery we're talking about in the Scriptures in the New Testament. That's really what it's like. That's the kind of, quote, slavery that Yahshua taught. The Scriptures taught. Yahshua didn't teach it, but how to deal with it. To show you what's right and what's wrong when it comes to this. So, here's the distinction. When you live by Yahweh's word, there should never be abuses anywhere in your life. Not in your family, not among your employees, not anywhere. Not in your marriage, the assembly. A slave in Israel was to be treated kind of like an employee, not like a dog. Throughout the New Testament, many texts actually show slavery as a model of behavior, believe it or not. We are related to Yahweh as his servants. In some respects, we're a slave to Yahweh. But in the right way, in the benevolent way. Repeatedly, whether in Ephesians 6, Colossians 4, 1 Timothy 6, 1 and 2, 1 Peter 2:18, slaves are told to be obedient and faithful to their masters no matter how they are treated and no matter how their masters are told to treat them. And they are told, by the way, to treat them with love and kindness and fairness, no matter what they might do. In Yahshua's day, slavery wasn't what we think of. Many historians say a man was even better off, a bona fide slave, than a free man or even a poor non-slave man. Poor. A man who's not a slave, but he's very destitute. Because very often the slave was better off than these other people. He was assured of good care. He had food. He had shelter. And if he had a benevolent master, life was rather good. There were different kinds of slavery, of course. Slaves of the established institutions of temple and palace were mainly prisoners of war. You find that in Numbers 31. Also Joshua 9, unlike the household slave. They were used in building projects, just as Israel had to do in Egypt. That was a different kind of slavery than what we're talking about. Egyptians didn't know how to manage a slave properly. But that's not what we're talking about. There was a kind of semi-slavery where a group of people in a certain situation could hire their own labor, but otherwise live as free people. And this is like an employer. This is what the Gibeonites did in Joshua in 9:23 that we talked about once before. They didn't want to be slaughtered by Israel, so they said, okay, and they, a little bit of a ruse, they got them to accept them. And so Israel, once they made a vow that they would not destroy these people, got a problem, and they said, okay, you can live as kind of our workforce. You can work for us, and, you know, you could help us do things, but you didn't have total freedom. Household slaves were different. You know, debt was the main factor in becoming a, transforming a peasant or a farmer or an artisan into a slave. They just couldn't afford it. So, okay, I'll work for you. I'll do what you want me to do. And there again, we're talking about, just like an employer, an employee today. Sometimes people sold themselves as slaves, just as we do when we work for somebody. In theory, such slaves in Israel returned to free status on the Jubilee year. We know about that. Slaves were freed. There again, it wasn't an issue of inequity. It was actual total equity, total goodness for the slave, that he was going to be freed whenever the Jubilee came around. In Israel, the master's rights were limited and the slave's interests were protected. Although severe beating was allowed, we find in Exodus 21:20, excessive force was punished by the slave being set free. You mishandled your slave, the judge would say he's free. You can't handle it. You don't know how to do it. You don't know how to keep a slave. He's gone. By Yahweh's law, Sabbath rest applied equally to slaves as well to free people. See, Yahweh looks at everybody the same. In Yahweh's eyes, we're all the children of Elohim. Slaves in the time of Yahshua could be fully educated in every discipline. Some even went into the medical profession. Slaves could take the benefit of owning their own property in some instances and developing their own economy. Slaves could leave their estates to their children. So it's not the kind of slavery that comes to mind when we think of slavery. Philemon was a good master, apparently. But Onesimus wants his freedom anyway, so he cuts and runs. His master, no doubt, had paid a premium for him, and this action constituted fraud. Onesimus was on the lam. Not only that, he steals from his master when he leaves. And so he becomes a criminal on the run, for which imprisonment or even death was the sentence if Philemon so chose. Fleeing to Rome to get lost in the crowd, Onesimus stumbles right into a very formidable man called the Apostle Paul. A city of a million people almost. He stumbles into Paul. Now, if that wasn't Yahweh's providence, I don't know what is. Paul witnesses to him, to Onesimus, and he becomes a believer. Now, Paul has an investment in this man, as well as Joshua. So now he's got a problem on his hands. He learns that this man is a runaway slave from his own friend Philemon. Oh boy, small world. In a city of this size, he runs into and gets converted by the great apostle, who is also the friend of his master. Clearly, Yahweh was in all of this. Paul knows he has to send Onesimus back to his owner, and he does so with a letter of explanation, and that's what you're reading right here in Philemon. As the letter unfolds, it becomes apparent that Paul is asking Philemon to forgive a repentant man. That's what it's all about. Forgive this repentant man. Onesimus has done his part by going back, hat in hand, to his master, asking for forgiveness. Now, what would you do if you were in Philemon's shoes? This guy has cost you considerable angst, money, expense, worry, and now he's coming back. What would you do? Untold grief and trouble. What would you do? Remember, what he did was a felony under Roman law. Our society today would have an answer. Just nail the scoundrel to the wall. Teach him that others like him have a huge lesson to learn. Show him he messed with the wrong slave owner this time. Press charges and throw him in the pokey. Throw away the key. Show him you mean business. That's the culture's response. But Paul pleads the unexpected. He says, simply, Philemon, forgive him. No matter how much it cost you, no matter how angry you were or are still, how badly you were wronged, forgive him. For your own sake, Philemon, just forgive him. Paul knows Philemon has a right to punish this man to the full extent of the law, but Paul decides to send him back anyway with this letter seeking clemency, seeking mercy, trusting in the goodness of a believer, in a believing family of believers. You've got to treat this slave the way Yahshua treated you. Same principle that he taught in Ephesians chapter 4. Verse 32, Colossians 3:13, that we are to forgive one another as Yahshua forgave us. And that's basically the background of this book of Philemon. Simple book, 25 verses. Nothing big, nothing really profound or in depth. And it's sandwiched between two other great books. But it teaches us a very important lesson, a very poignant lesson about forgiveness. So what's going to happen to our slave Onesimus when he goes back? The rest of the book in verses 4 onwards splits it into three parts. The first part, verses 4 to 7, basically deals with the spiritual nature of someone who forgives. What kind of person is a forgiving person? Then the second part, verses 8 to 18 of the book, is about what a person does when he forgives. What's the next step? Then from verses 19 to 25 is the spiritual motivation of one who forgives. Why does he do it? How? By the time we're done, we'll have a better idea of the essentials of forgiveness in character, in our motivation, and in our very actions. You know, a believer is never more like Yahshua than when he forgives. What is the biggest, most important act Yahshua did? He forgave our sins. The penalty for our, he paid our penalty of our sins and forgave them, right? There's nothing bigger in the scriptures than that. Is what Yahshua did to make salvation possible for you and for me. He forgave. The nature of Yahweh's forgiveness is seen in the parable of the prodigal son. Total and complete clemency. The unpleasant chastening of one who doesn't forgive is seen in another parable, the forgiving king and the unforgiving servant. This is interesting. Let's turn to Matthew 18. I don't have this on the big screen, so let's just read through this real quickly. Matthew 18, verse 23. Again, Matthew 18 says so much about forgiveness. If you want to review what Yahshua says, just read the chapter. Matthew 18, verse 23. Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king, which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him, which owed him 10,000 talents. But for as much as he had not to pay, his master commanded him to be sold and his wife and children, and all that he had, and payment to be made. The servant, therefore, fell down and worshipped him, saying, Master, have patience with me. I'll repay you all. Just give me a little time. Have some mercy on me. I'll repay it. I don't intend to get away with this. I don't intend to steal from you. And the master of that servant was moved with compassion and loosed him and forgave him the debt. He even forgave the debt. But the same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants. I guess he was a little bit up on the ladder in the hierarchy. He found another fellow servant who served him, which owed him 100 pence. He laid hands, this is really amazing. He laid hands on this guy and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, have patience with me. I will repay you all. Just give me a little time. He wouldn't do it. He would not do it. Do you see yourself in this? Yahshua paid it all, forgave us that debt. And yet we're going to hold a grudge against somebody? And he cast him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what was done, they were very sorry and came and told unto their master all that was done. Then the master, after he had called him, said unto him, O you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you desired me. You asked me, and I forgave you. Should you not also have compassion on your servant, even as I had pity on you? And his master was wroth and delivered him to the tormentors till he should pay all that was due unto him. So likewise, here's the rub, here's the thrust of it all, shall my heavenly Father do also unto you, if you from your hearts forgive not everyone his brother their trespasses. Obviously trespasses against you. Amazing, this man either had a very short memory, or he was just a nasty guy. So here we are. In the book of Philemon, we discover the spiritual nature of one who forgives. In effect, he's saying, Philemon, I know you're a kind of man I can trust to forgive your slave, Onesimus. He's setting him up by reminding him of his own good behavior. He tactfully praises Philemon. Paul uses this kind of psychology all the time. I don't really like that term. I think it best describes, you know, his angle. He knows how to play people, so to speak. And I'm not saying that in a, you know, mischievous or a sinful way. He just knows the right angle. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with getting your point across by, you know, using certain ways to do it that would, you know, result in the most impact. So anyway, this is how he's doing. He tactfully praises Philemon, providing a framework for what he expects is a right decision, basically. There's a saying that goes, don't tell people what they should be, tell them what they are. Praise the good side. Praise, you know, the right characteristics, the traits of them, and they'll want to live up to that. Instead of saying, you dummy, can't you do things right, you know, as sometimes we do to our children, without thinking. Tell them what they are. Praise them. They're going to want to live up to it, of your expectations as well. Well, let's go back to Philemon. There's only one chapter. Verse 5. Hearing of your love and faith, which you have toward the Master Yahshua and toward all saints. He says, Brother Philemon, I know you're one of Yahweh's own. I mean, after something like that, from a guy like this, who's out converting the world with his powerful message and his ways, what could you say? He says, I know, I've heard of your love and faith, that the communication of your faith may become effectual by the acknowledging of every good thing which is in you in Messiah, Yahshua. For we have great joy and consolation, I'm in verse 7, in your love, because the bowels of the saints are refreshed by you, brother. Therefore, though I might be much bold in Messiah to enjoin you that which is convenient, So he's gone ahead and praising him. So then in verse 8 he says, okay, that's why I'm boldly asking a favor of you. I could demand it in the name of Yahshua because it's the right thing for you to do. I could virtually force you by my position, by my having faced Yahshua, the risen Messiah, and been taught by him face to face. I could use that on you. But no, I'm going to appeal to your heart. I'm not going to force you. I'm going to appeal to your heart to enjoin you. Yet for your love's sake, I rather beseech you, being such as one as Paul the aged, now also a prisoner of Yahshua. He says, but because of our love, I prefer simply to ask you, consider this as a request from me, a fellow brother. I'm an old man, and now also a prisoner for the sake of Messiah. Obviously, he's in prison. Some say he's in Rome when he's writing this. Onesimus is kind of his right-hand man, out there doing some work while he's in prison. He said, the man has done me some good. He's really part of my ministry at this point. Now please, forgive him, his debt to you. He says, I became his father in the faith while here in prison, in verse 10. Which in time past was to you unprofitable, but now profitable to you and me. Okay, yeah, I know, he took off. He took off with some of your money. He did what was wrong. He realizes that he repents. He's converted. He wasn't any good to you then, but now he's not only good to me, but he's good to you. How much better person he is now. He's not going to ever do this again. I don't think. He's a believer. He knows if he does, he's finished. He goes back. Now I've sent again, you therefore receive him that is mine own bowels. Receive this man. I'm sending him back to you, and with him comes my own heart, whom I have retained with me, that in your stead he might have ministered unto me in the bonds of the good news. I wanted to keep him here with me while I have these chains so that he could preach the good news. And he would have helped me on your behalf. But verse 14 says, but without thy mind would I do nothing, that your benefits should not be as it were of necessity, but willingly. I don't want to do anything without your approval. You've got the authority over him, and I'm not going to usurp that authority. I wanted you to help because you were willing, not because you were forced. Paul is seeking freedom for this man so he can actually come back and maybe help him in the ministry too. He sees all sorts of advantages here. Verse 15, but for perhaps he therefore departed for a season that you should receive him forever. It seems you lost Onesimus for a little while so that you could have him back forever. What is he talking about? On up and through the kingdom, brethren. Through the kingdom when Yahweh resurrects him and you to be with you forever and with Yahshua in the kingdom. That's what we're talking about. Man, it doesn't get any dearer than that. Verse 16, now as a servant, but above a servant, a brother, beloved, especially to me, but how much more unto you, both in the flesh and in the master. He's no longer like a slave to you. He's more than a slave now, he says. For he's a beloved brother, especially to me. Now he will mean much more to you, both as a man and as a brother in the master. Now that he's converted, everything's changed. The dynamics have all changed for both of us. I didn't know the man when he first bumped into me. Now, he's so close to my heart, he's a brother, and as close as anything here on earth. Verse 17, if you count me therefore a partner, receive him as myself. If you consider me your partner, welcome him as you would welcome me. Do you think this man has a choice? I can't see that he has to forgive him. He has to. Verse 18, if he has wronged you or owe you anything, put that on my account. He says, if he's wronged you or stolen from you, charge it to me. I'll pay it. That's how much he loves this man, how much he knows that he needs forgiveness. All right, verse 19. Very peculiar passage, very, very strange and hard to understand. He says, I, Paul, have written it with my own hand. I will repay it, albeit I do not say to you how you owe unto me even your own self besides. What is he saying? He says, I write this with my own hand. I mean, this. I'm not faxing you. I'm not emailing you. I'm not doing it through a third person. It's in my own handwriting. I'm writing this letter. And I won't mention that you owe me your very soul. If he didn't make the point up to this point, he drives it home. Here Paul takes the part of Yahshua in offering to pay any debt Onesimus may owe. And don't forget, if it weren't for me, you would not have your own sins forgiven through Yahshua. Apparently, it was his disciple too. He said, look, I'm your mentor. I'm your teacher. I'm the one that brought you the truth. What more can I say? This is the crux of the relationship between slave and master. The master is really no better than a slave. He also has to take up the behavior of a slave in relationship to the Almighty Yahweh. That's what he's saying. We all have to become slaves. We all have to willingly do what he says. Don't fight it. Do it. If he says, keep my commandments, we say, okay. We don't say, which ones? I'll do all but the seventh or all but the fourth. There you go. All but the fourth. I'll keep them all, but that Sabbath, I mean, I might lose my job. I can't get a job. I mean, on and on and on. Oh, you can't. I know hundreds of people who can. They just had to make a stand. I cannot work that day, and I won't. Well, if you can't work there, find a place that you can work. They're out there. Yea, brother, let me have joy. Verse 20. He's kind of summing it up now. Make me happy. Refresh my bowels. Refresh my heart. Please do this favor for me, for the Master's sake. Give me the encouragement in Messiah. Having confidence in your obedience, I wrote unto you, knowing that you will also do more than I say. I know you're going to do the right thing, and I know you're even going to do more. That's what he's saying. Excuse me. You'll do more than I ask. James puts it this way in chapter 2, verse 13. There will be judgment without mercy for those who have not been merciful themselves. Judgment without mercy. That clinches it for me. Or to take it on a positive note, the Beatitude says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy themselves. You want mercy? Give it. You want forgiveness? Give it and forgive like Yahweh did for you. You know, you're never more like Yahshua when you forgive. Ephesians 4:31. Well, let's look at 4:26. The link on the screen. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. And do not give the devil a foothold. You see, when you don't do things according to Yahweh's command, there's only another way you can do it. Through the evil one. He's the one that's pulling you away, and he's going to use everything he can to pull you away. And the most powerful thing he can use is your own human nature, that own resistance, that natural resistance to doing what's right. So in verse 31 of Ephesians 4, Paul said, let there be no more bitter resentment or anger, no more shouting or slander, and let there be no bad feeling of any kind among you. Be kind to each other. Be compassionate. Be as ready to forgive others as Yahweh, for Messiah's sake, has forgiven you. Pretty much sums it up. Paul says in verse 5 of Ephesians 6, he shows the parallel between servant and master, between Yahweh and his people. Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters, according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and singleness of your heart, as unto Messiah. Verse 6, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Messiah. We listen, we march to a different drummer. We don't do it for personal advantage, to get in good with somebody. We do it because of Yahshua. See, we have a whole different goal in our life. We're like a parallel universe. We're going along living in this world, but we're doing things for different reasons than the world does. They're doing it for advantage. They're doing it for position. They're doing it for George Washington. We're doing it for Yahweh. Everything we do is focused on that, to keep our heart and mind on Yahweh. That's why we do it, or should, not to please men. With goodwill, doing service as to the Messiah, and not to men, knowing that whatsoever good thing any man does, the same shall he receive of Yahweh, whether he's bond or free. It doesn't matter if you're a slave or a free man. Again, Yahweh is neutral. It's kind of like, you know, the... what's that? You see it on courthouses, you got the blind, justice is blind, you know, the lady's got the blindfold. In other words, they're supposed to be neutral, not look at, you know, things according to prejudice or according to preconceived ideas. Supposed to be just looking at the facts and judging that way. And that's what he's saying. Yahweh judges that way. He judges you by your actions. And you, masters, do the same thing unto them, forbearing, threatening. Don't go along and threaten people with things, knowing that your master also is in heaven. Neither is there respect of persons with him. We are all created in Yahweh's image. There's no real difference between us and a slave. Our station in this life has no bearing on what we will be in the next. I remember there was a group that thought that your position in the assembly is going to determine your position in the kingdom. So they walked all over each other, pushing everybody down to climb the ladder so they could be top dog, because they thought for eternity they'll be up there. Are you kidding me? What does the scripture say? First shall be last, the last first. Your position now has nothing to do with what you're going to be in the kingdom. I remember a brother said something to me that was very profound. I'd never thought about it before. We had gone through a trial, and he said, you know, if you harbor bitterness against somebody, what are you going to do when you're facing them in the kingdom? Face to face in the kingdom, what are you going to say? What are you going to do? Forgive, brethren, forgive. A business teacher once gave a test to his class on the practical aspects of business and finance. They're going to be going out into the world, so he gave him a test. Student Bill thought he aced the test until he came to the very last question, which was, what is the first name of the janitor that you see every day coming in the hallway to this class? He looked at that. He went up to the teacher and says, come on. You're kidding, right? I mean, this is a joke. The teacher says, professor says, that question counts just as much as all the other questions do. After the test, the instructor explained to the class, you know, the janitor question wasn't a trick question, nor was it there for amusement purposes. In your careers, you're going to discover that all people are important, from the top to the bottom. All are going to be important to your success. Don't ever neglect or overlook anyone. Anyone. There will come times when those who take care of the mundane, basic needs are going to be the most important of all. And you know, Yahweh says the same thing to us. Don't ever feel superior or more honored than anybody else. This is a lesson also to Philemon. Yeah, he was a slave, but now he's equal with us. He's equal with us, Philemon. I know he's equal with me. And Paul, I guess, is considered the greatest apostle, at least as far as his work, than anyone else. But Paul considered him equal. Paul was imprisoned. He was a lowly slave, essentially, at this point. And he uses this man to help him in the ministry. He developed into a key component, cementing the relationship between a legendary apostle and his trusted brother in the faith. Forgiveness, it's so important. You know, David shows forgiveness in 2 Samuel chapter 9. It's an account we don't ever read much about, but I want to do that today. 2 Samuel chapter 9. David said, "Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Jonathan was a bosom buddy, you might say, to David. Yeah, Saul treated him rottenly, about as bad as anybody could. I mean, he tried to kill him, throwing spears at him and everything. David says, "But for Jonathan's sake, I want to treat somebody in that family. Kindness. Is there anybody?" "And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba. And when they had called him unto David, the king said unto him, 'Are you Ziba?' And he said, 'Thy servant is he. I am.' And the king said, 'Is there not yet any of the house of Saul that I might show the kindness of Elohim unto him?' And Ziba said unto the king, 'Jonathan has yet a son, which is lame on his feet.'" He was a cripple. "And the king said unto him, 'Where is he?' Ziba said unto King David, 'Behold, he's in the house of Machor, the son of Amiel and Lodabar.' Then King David sent and fetched him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, and from Lodabar. And now when Mephibosheth, there's a good tongue twister. When Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was come unto David, he fell on his face and did reverence. And David said, 'Mephibosheth,'" he got it right the first time. "And he answered, 'Behold your servant.' And David said unto him, 'Fear not, for I will surely show you kindness for David, thy servant, your father's sake, David, your father's sake, Jonathan, your father's sake. And I will restore you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat bread at my table continually.'" Wow. He's going to give this man a big inheritance, a kingly inheritance. He says, "You're going to eat at my table from now on." And he bowed himself and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I am?" I guess he felt, "I'm crippled, I'm worthless, I'm nothing." And he bowed himself to the king. Then the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said unto him, "I have given unto your master's son all that pertains to Saul and to all his house." It's rightfully his. It's his inheritance. "And I'm going to do that because I forgave Saul and all the evil they did to me, and I'm going to reward this man all that he had. You therefore and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him, and you shall bring in the fruits that your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat bread always at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then said Ziba unto the king, "According to all that my master the king has commanded his servants, so shall your servant do." I'll do it. I'll do what you've said. "As for Mephibosheth," said to the king, "he shall eat at my table as one of the king's sons." And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all that dwell in the house of Ziba were servants unto Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he did eat continually at the king's table and was lame on both his feet. Wow. In doing this, David altered what could have been a man's fate. Changed his fate for life. He, in doing this, adhered to the law, Leviticus 19:18. "You shall not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh. Love your neighbor as yourself. We're told in Proverbs 24:17, rejoice not when your enemy falls, nor let your heart be glad when he stumbles. Ha ha ha, he got his. Common human reaction. He says, don't rejoice. Getting even is the attitude of the evil one. Proverbs 24:29, say not, I will do so to him as he has done to me. I will render the man according to his work. I'll get even. Don't do that. That's of the evil one. And even when you see him come under hard times, don't get smug and self-satisfied and say, yep, that's what he deserved. Forgiveness is one of the greatest virtues of the believer. In fact, in Yasha's case, it is, I think, that and love for the brethren, the greatest virtue he had for his people. But one of the hardest to do, it goes against our very grain. It really does. It goes against human nature. But isn't that what we're trying to do, brethren? Isn't that what we're trying to do, is overcome our nature to become like Yahshua? He did things that so unexpected, people couldn't believe it. I mean, he'd go up and just heal somebody just because he wanted to heal somebody. I mean, what did this guy do for him? And he'd do it again and again and again. Turn around, there's somebody else. He'd heal, turn around, and heal him. He would forgive people. He would forgive. You know, there's, when he says, when he's on the stake, for Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. There's some who believe he says that should be, Father, forgive them not, for they know what they do. That's really not so, because other verses also talk about his forgiveness of those that did that to him. So that's really what he said. Forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. When you're ignorant of what you're doing, if you don't know the consequences, if you don't really understand, then Yahweh can forgive. We do a sin and we don't know that it's sin, he'll forgive it. But we do know it's sin and do it anyway, that's a different story. But that, brethren, is what salvation is all about. That's what we're working toward. Without Yahweh's forgiveness and Yahshua's death, where would we be? Where would we, Onesimus, be in the great scheme? May Yahweh bless you.